A letter to my mother. As I sit on the beach, my human senses long to hear, feel, see, and know you. The gravity of the ocean waves pull at my insecurities, dissolving uncertainty and reassuring me of what is known deep inside as solid truth. That never were there any real doubts of your love for me.
Has too much time passed for there to be justice for Lyn Dawson?
No, not in my view. No, I believe that he could be charged tomorrow, and probably should be, because he's in this awkward situation, having been found by two coroners to have likely murdered his wife. But the rest of the system won't prosecute him.
And why not?
Well, I think that the DPP has misunderstood aspects of the evidence. And I also believe that the police failed to find a really key document early in the piece.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And it's me, Lisa Zieg, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague.
So we're in the middle of our continuing coverage of the Teacher's Pet podcast and the incredible results that is obtained by moving this case forward after 37 years. And part of that forward movement is not only contact with Hedley Thomas, but we've also been contacted by family members of Lynette Dawson. And Laura has some pretty interesting information from them.
Yes, well, many of them have been listening to our podcast and have found the insight and analysis that we've offered very illuminating. And I think when we last discussed, in our last two episodes, we talked about the diary entries and obviously said that they were very significant pieces of evidence. And Jim, you and I went back and forth because of Lisa's question about, you know, why was it that Helena kept the diaries and why we think that she had asked Pat to destroy them.
Right.
A couple of the family members emailed and they basically said that they haven't all cited the diary entries. But the contents of some of that information is obviously discussed in Hedley Thomas's podcast. And they said that Helena was someone who wrote every detail down. She was that person who wrote on the back of every photo, the place, the person, the date. She was really about the attention to detail. And she was also of a generation, and I guess sometimes we forget this, but a generation that didn't really talk about emotions and feelings openly. And so this was her way of writing down what was happening, but also how she felt about it. And, you know, she just, even if she was on a phone call, she apparently would leave notes everywhere of who it was that she spoke to, what the detail was. And she said things like she just didn't want to forget. You know, so, I mean, I'm a note taker too. I write things down. And in the later stages of her life, she was ill. So she wasn't living at home for 3 months. And, you know, apparently her generation, there's a lot of people, and including my mother, you know, and others who kept diaries and notes of events. And she probably didn't realize that they would become significant in the case. But of course, they are very important.
But when we say, you know, I think there's a context difference too. You know, in America, when we say diary, we often visualize that as like a private book that isn't necessarily dated, but it's just like a blank book and you write Dear Diary and you write all your thoughts and your feelings and you go on and on and on for pages and pages. But, you know, when I lived in London and somebody would say, oh, I'll put our meeting in the diary, it took me a while to be like, what? No, it's just, it's a calendar and it's got just enough space to put, you know, what a calendar would have. And so you'd only have enough room to jot a few things down. You wouldn't have the space to go on and on and on about all the inner workings of your soul.
Right. And also diaries back then, 37 years ago, were basically the Instagram and Twitter and Facebook of today. And so I think that Helena was sort of using that to sort of chronicle her life and her experiences. And like you said, Laura, because she didn't want to forget them. And that's obviously immensely helpful for us, because instead of speculating as to what was going through her mind, she tells us.
Right. And that is a clear account, not just her emotions, but who was doing what at what time. And I think we discussed one of the entries that where she'd mentioned that Joanne was sleeping in Chris Dawson's bed. And, you know, how did that come to pass? Well, one of the family members have basically let me know through contacting me that Helena had said to the girls, Chanel and Sharon, that she hadn't been coming round to sleep there because there wasn't enough room. There was nowhere for her to sleep, because if Joanne was there, they'd be sleeping in the study. Well, apparently Chanel piped up that you can sleep in Daddy's bed. Joanne does. And that straight
out of her mouth. Oh, God.
Yeah. There you go.
The innocence of children who just report on what they're seeing.
Yeah, that's exactly what we thought, that it was just a utterance by someone who didn't see that it was a negative thing.
That's right. And she also said that Helena was very conscious of not using the children to try and get information out or to create a pressure on them or, you know, use them for information. And she was frightened that she was going to lose contact with them, which, of course, she eventually did. But on some of the occasions where the girls innocently told her things that were happening behind closed doors, and Helena did take Chris to task on numerous things, and he would just turn around apparently and say things like, well, children make things up, they make up stories and they lie, and, you know, he basically didn't give it any credence at all. It sounds like they were saying quite a lot about what was going on. And of course, what we talked about, the diary entries, that's what was published in Hedley Thomas's podcast, but I believe there are many more entries that we haven't seen. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, are more detailed. And we also talked about Greg Walsh, who is representing Chris Dawson, and what he said outside of court after the last appearance. And it just popped back into my mind, because on the one hand, he said, well, I haven't seen the diary entries, and that they were going to prove critical in this case. And then in the same interview, he also said that these diary entries were going to basically support Chris Dawson. And so how could he, on the one hand, say that they were, you know, significant to his client's case, but on the other hand, he hadn't even seen them or read them?
Laura, can I just tell you a little secret about defense attorneys? Well, sometimes they lie to try to spin the truth for the benefit of their clients. I know it's crazy. I know it's way out there, but sometimes they actually do that.
Thank you for the avalanche of emails I'm going to get now from defense attorneys. So we should also point out that prosecutors sometimes do the same thing. So
that prosecutors lie to
sometimes. Sometimes
yeah,
they lie.
I guess.
Let's just keep.
When you have prosecutors who break the law,
yes,
that's what's happening. Yes, they have to act, by doing that, they actually break the law. However, defense attorneys are legally allowed to represent their client, make accusations against people they know are not guilty to protect their knowingly guilty client. And that is something that prosecutors can't do. That would be illegal for a prosecutor to do. This is a very important point.
Good distinction. Good.
Well, it's certainly interesting. Greg Walsh had a lot to say outside of court. And I think if we see more of that, then, you know, we're going to be able to analyze what his strategy might well be. And, you know, that yes, there certainly seemed to be grandstanding, you know, because again, and I think I mentioned it, that on the one hand, he said that he felt that his client was overwhelmed, was daunted by the fact that the police and the prosecutors were against him. And then I see another interview of Peter Dawson stood with Chris Dawson and Greg Walsh, and the interviewer asks, you know, are you feeling overwhelmed? Are you feeling under pressure? And he just turns around, Peter Dawson, and immediately says, we're not under pressure. We're not overwhelmed. And again, just which one is it? You have Greg Walsh saying, my poor client, and playing for the sympathy vote. And then you see the Dawson brothers together who are fronting it out, bravado, arrogance, haughty, saying, we're not under pressure.
Spin versus bravado, right? That's what you have there. One lawyer is trying to spin it to make it look like their client is being taken advantage of. The other lawyer is selling blustery confidence because he doesn't want to look weak or doesn't want his brother to look weak. It's totally different tactics. I mean, we've seen, I believe in the past, Peter Dawson has been very aggressive, and his demeanor to me looks, and what I've heard of him speaking and the statements he's made in defense of his brother have been very in your face. And so I would expect him to try to show off rather than to try to play the aggrieved, injured party.
Right. Well, I think that's an interesting point. I'd be interested in your view, because obviously we know there were two coroner's inquiries. There was one in 2001, and it was a female coroner who presided, and she had determined that a known person had killed Lynn Dawson. So, and that was Chris Dawson. So Nicholas Cowdery, who was the DPP at the time, the Director of Public Prosecutions, he said that that process was not thorough enough. He basically said he wanted each of the witnesses interviewed and that he didn't just want the statements because he felt possibilities hadn't been explored. Mm-hmm. And therefore there would be no prosecution based on what the coroner's recommendations were. So hence that takes us to 2003 and the next coroner's inquest. And so those who made statements were questioned in court and their evidence was tested. Now, I think we mentioned it before that Peter Dawson was one of those individuals who cross-examined the witnesses. And what I've subsequently found out from people who were cross-examined by him was that he was very aggressive to them and very emotional. And he was reined in multiple times by the coroner, who actually said that they were going to suspend proceedings if he didn't rein his behavior in. Mm. What's your view on that? I mean, it just seems ridiculous that he, who is the brother of Chris Dawson, is cross-examining, you know, witnesses, significant witnesses.
Well, you know, unfortunately, Laura, because of the sort of anomaly of legal representation, it creates an incredibly impenetrable bond between client and lawyer. And that lawyer, whether he's related to the defendant or not, that lawyer has certain rights to confront those accusers against his client. And so they give them a fair amount of latitude. I think we both know at least some other lawyers who have a reputation for being bullies and try to basically bully their way through the legal system. And whoever they have to step on throughout that process, it doesn't matter to them. So I think he's just a perfect example of that type of lawyer. There's been a number of them throughout history. And unfortunately, because he is related and not just this sort of neutral, detached attorney that is representing Chris Dawson, because he's related, the victim's family, the relatives of Lynn Dawson would obviously feel that he has more of a connection. He represents Chris in more than just a legal way. He's actually his brother. He actually is part of his family. And they're offended by this. And I think rightly so, because that family has done a tremendous, horrible thing. It's a tremendous disservice to Lynn Dawson and her entire family. Lynn Dawson is no longer here. And them, that family, circling the wagons and protecting Chris, which isn't absolutely true for the entire family, because there have been some cousins, some other relatives who have come forward, and they're disgusted by what they see, what they found out about Chris and his behavior, and about his twin brother and his behavior, and about Peter and his behavior. So there are actually good people in the Dawson extended family who do care about Lynn and don't want to see Chris get away with anything, and they want to see justice for Lynn.
Lynn loved that house and the kids were happy there. It's such a pretty house and it could have been such a lovely home. And sex and greed killed it.
Well, I would imagine that the family, you know, some of those people who were cross-examined by him were sort of rabbits caught in the headlights. You know, not only are you there to give your account of what's gone on, but then you've got And he does look very much like Chris Dawson. Having now seen him, you've got a Chris Dawson lookalike being aggressive and cross-examining you in such a way that the coroner says that they will suspend proceedings, which I wonder why they didn't suspend proceedings.
Well, that's sort of like a judge saying to a lawyer here in the United States, if you don't curtail that conduct, I'm going to find you in contempt of court. And that means he could get fined, he could get jailed, and he may even get disbarred. So I think those threats typically cause lawyers to kind of tote it down. And apparently, if they didn't suspend the proceedings, Peter must have heeded that warning and toned it down a little bit. But the damage was already done. I mean, if he's already been aggressive with the witness, and if he's done this repeatedly, the witnesses probably all know about that treatment, and they're frightened by it. They're intimidated by it, and rightly so. Lawyers are perfectly at home in a courtroom and in the middle of an inquest. Typically, witnesses are not, and it is a foreign land to them. It's a tremendous amount of pressure and stress and the spotlight on them, especially when they're testifying about something so emotional as losing their sister or their daughter or their cousin. And so it's a very difficult time for lay witnesses. And I just think it's wrong for lawyers to sort of abuse the system by abusing witnesses instead of literally being professional and not getting emotional with people who have every right to be there and they want justice for their loved one.
But the fact he's conflicted right from the start, I mean, that's the problem that I have with it, that he's conflicted because he's the brother. Surely that would be something that the coroner should have ruled on in and of itself. And I also wonder how that's going to play into the criminal trial. You know, given that he is a significant witness of sorts, because we know about phone calls, right? That Chris made phone calls to him, particularly about Bayview and whether he should sell Bayview, you know, what would happen if he left Bayview.
You're absolutely right. Peter Dawson was actually part and parcel of the motive that everyone believes drove Chris to actually get rid of Lynn Dawson. And so because of that, I believe in the United States anyway, they should have been able to get an order from the court to say that Peter Dawson has a conflict of interest and he cannot represent his brother because he is actually a witness.
Yeah, now, he could be a witness to her domestic abuse too, right?
I mean, yes, he's potentially a witness to that as well. But the problem is, Laura, that for decades, there was no actual legal process. And it wasn't until these inquests, many years later, that anybody even tried to do anything with the criminal justice system. So I think given that time, people just lost track of the fact that he actually was a significant witness and could have provided the prosecution with motive for murder.
Right. I mean, coroners are powerful in the UK, and I think they're as powerful in Australia. So I do find that situation very bizarre. And, you know, that was 2003. It wasn't that long ago. And of course, in that inquest in 2003, it came out from Joanne that Chris Dawson had talked about hiring a hitman. And it also came out via Joanne's her evidence that Chris and Paul were having sex with students.
And including her, right?
Including her and using the school as a playground.
I mean, together, including her. In other words, the two of them were having sex with Joanne.
At the same time, yes.
And then Paul approached her and had sex with her outside of Chris's presence.
Yes, so that coming out, and many other things too. The second coroner took the view that Lynn Dawson was murdered by a known person. And that known person being Chris Dawson, and he should be prosecuted. Well, what then happens next is the DPP, Nicholas Cowdery, decides not to prosecute. Now, you know, I've been asking quite a lot of people about that decision, you know, and we've seen cases where that happens too, but there were two cases happening at similar times, and the DPP has said things that were contradictory. And he said in this case, and I wrote it down, he said that without a body, without witnesses, without knowing if she is dead, it's very hard to mount a case with a reasonable prospect of conviction just on motive and undefined existence of means and opportunity. that makes the case very weak.
First of all, I don't know how you can possibly say there was a lack of means and opportunity. There was one person, one adult person, who had access to her. We know that that adult person had given her a drink and that she sounds sloshed and that she was never seen alive again after that. That's plenty of motive and opportunity and means. So that means he didn't listen to the evidence. But the other things, yes, it is difficult, but it is not impossible. As I said earlier, the Behavioral Analysis Unit, the FBI, keeps track of all the no-body homicide prosecutions that are successful in the United States of America, and there are plenty of them. So it's not impossible. And I just think it's a weak, ridiculous excuse.
But this is what he also said. He's talking about Chris Dawson, he's either someone responsible for his wife's death or someone who was deserted by his wife. We don't know which one. I mean, it's just such a bizarre statement, given that there was no sight and there's no evidence of her being alive, but the family felt that he made decisions based on the fact that he thought Lynn had been sighted. But Pat Jenkins was told that was part of his decision. And when Pat explained to him that it's not possible Helena, for example, saw her without saying anything to the family, and that those sightings, it was never been anybody independent of Chris Dawson, that apparently the DPP and others suggested that maybe she killed herself and that she had driven or got herself to this place called The Gap. And this is new information that I've only recently heard about, that she had managed to get to The Gap, which was a popular suicide place in the eastern suburbs, which apparently there was no public transport to it. And that it was being suggested that she had killed herself.
Well, when you say The Gap, it sounds to me like you're talking about a cliff or something like that. Is that what it is?
Yes, and jumped off of it.
And is it a cliff into the ocean, or is it?
I'm not sure what you would land into, but that's my assumption, that it's into the ocean.
And then of course,
yes, no, it's an ocean cliff on the South Head Peninsula in eastern Sydney.
Okay, well,
it faces the Tasman Sea.
Right. Well, it's 100% pure speculation, and for her to get there, and to get there without anybody helping her and knowing about it. I mean, again, it's just all speculation. There's nothing. There's not a scintilla of evidence that supports that. It is simply a theory. And we know, Laura, because we've been in law enforcement, you can't just rely on a theory or hypothesis. You have to find things that corroborate it before it has any weight. And when everything else points to something exactly opposite to that, you can't credit some bizarre theory and some hypothesis and say that has equal weight to what all of these witnesses say, to what everybody knows has actually happened. And it just burns me up.
But how could she have killed herself and yet still called her husband on multiple occasions? I mean, you can't have both. He can't
claim that she's
still calling him and contacting him if, you know, so that doesn't track.
Yeah, so she would have had to kill herself after she came and bought sweaters and jeans and called Chris a bunch of times and told him that she was here and there and going there. It's so frustrating that the prosecution would actually credit that in this case.
I think there are holes in her story. But when it comes to, is Kelly Lane a cold-blooded murderer of her baby, from where we're standing, we're questioning whether that was proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, it's just so bizarre that he makes that decision, Nicholas Cowdery, even though two coroners have made recommendations that Chris Dawson should be prosecuted. And then you've got, at a similar time, the case of Kelly Lane happening, which we discussed a little bit about it. She was the elite water polo player She played water polo at both national and international level. She was blonde, or she is, I should say, she's in prison at the moment, but blonde, popular, attractive. And she had, you know, multiple pregnancies. Now, in 1996, she had a second baby, Tegan. So she'd already had a baby that nobody knew anything about, that had been put up for adoption. She then got pregnant again, which no one knew anything about. And she had the baby. Now, this baby was called Tegan. This was on the 12th of September in 1996. And she claims that that baby she gave to the man who got her pregnant. Now, she appears at a wedding straight after giving birth, with not telling anybody where she'd been, or not even looking like she had been in the hospital. But she then gets pregnant again in 1999. So fast forward to 99, and she was refused an abortion. She wasn't allowed a termination, so she had to have the baby. And she wanted to put it up for adoption. And so she puts the baby up for adoption. The person, one of the child protection officers that she talks to, does some searching on her and the hospital where she had the baby in, and found out that she had given birth two times before that, and questioned her about that, and she lied. She said that she hadn't been pregnant before, which means that this protection officer, John, starts digging into her even more. And because of the lie, he alerts the police. Now, this is in 2001, so we've got the coroner's inquest for Lynn Dawson, the first one in 2001 too. So this is Manly as well. So it's the same area. So 2001, the police investigate. They find out that, yes, she did have another baby. And she had said that she had given this baby Tegan to an Andrew Morris or Norris. So the name changes. And that she had had a relationship with him. They were unable to track him down. And so they didn't pursue the case. They just assumed that that's what had happened. Now, in 2003, they re-interview her again about this matter, and she changes the name. She said that this time it was Norris, and Andrew Norris, and that she hadn't told people about these pregnancies for fear of the reaction from her own family, from her friends, and that she felt really alone, and she felt she had no other choice. When she got pregnant, she couldn't have a termination. And the police dug into her even more in terms of her background and what was going on. They couldn't find any information about baby Tegan. They couldn't find this Andrew Morris. Manly police refer the matter to the coroner. So this is now 2005-06. Mm-hmm. Now, the coroner inquest, basically, they recommend that further investigation is required and that they believe that Tegan was deceased. So the police continue their investigation, but they couldn't locate, even through continuing trying to find this Andrew Morris or Norris, and they had no records of this baby Tegan. And that it was a two-year search for both of them. Now, they concluded, the police, that there was no evidence and no physical evidence and no witness pointing to the fact that the baby was deceased, and they decided not to charge her. So they then put their case file to the DPP saying, our recommendation is no charge. The DPP, who is Nicholas Cowdery, makes a decision that she should be charged.
Wow.
She's charged. Go ahead. No body, no evidence, no witnesses. So the very same standard that he set in Lynn Dawson's case, he now applies in a different way to this case.
Yeah, what's crazy about that is that also the coroner's inquest, was it the coroner's inquest or was the police department?
Police and coroners.
Okay, so the
back to the police again saying, you need to investigate this matter further. You must try and locate this Andrew Norris Morris. You must do more to try and locate this baby.
And the police basically say, we don't think she should be prosecuted. And yet he goes against that recommendation and prosecutes her.
The police say there's no conclusive evidence or physical evidence pointing to baby Tegan's death, and therefore they decided not to charge her. But the DPP overrides that. She is charged. She goes to trial in August 2010. And I think I mentioned it before, but it's really her promiscuity that's on trial, her sexual promiscuity.
Wow.
The fact that she had numerous pregnancies that she had hid. I think she'd been pregnant 5 times in 7 years. And that was really the Crown's case, the fact that she lied, and therefore they felt that that equated to guilt. And they basically argued that her lies were evidence of consciousness. But there was the defence offered no evidence at all. And, you know, in real terms, did the Crown, having dug into it a little bit, did they ever really prove beyond reasonable doubt that she killed baby Tegan? Well, no. There was no real investigation when Kelly Lane had talked about going to this hotel and having sex with this man, Andrew Norris. They never followed that line of inquiry. Now, a documentarian, someone called Caro Meldrum Hannah, and she's got a 3-part documentary called Exposed, and she's done a brilliant job of sort of piecing together what was known, what are the questions that still remain, and this documentary going out there has meant significant witnesses have come forward, and a man has come forward that puts Kelly Lane in that hotel with a man at the time she said she was having sex with this man. Now, also, Caro Meldrum Hannah brought in a forensic sketch artist, a very experienced police officer who went in to question Kelly Lane, and he basically went in expecting to come out quite quickly in the fact that he felt that she had been lying. Now, he was in with her for some time, and he felt, by all accounts, the detail that she went into and the fact he didn't lead her on any point pointed to veracity and that it was an authentic account and that this man did exist. And so he produced a sketch, which now has gone out there as to, you know, can anyone identify this man who had this baby Tegan? Well, I mean, that may be useful to her now, but she actually was found guilty of murder, irrespective of the fact there was no body, there's no evidence that's conclusive, there's no witnesses, but she was still found guilty and she was sentenced to an 18-year prison sentence to serve 13 years and 5 months. So she is in prison now and her appeals have been rejected thus far, but it's the same man, Nicholas Cowdery, the DPP. He was interviewed by Caro Meldrum Hannah about the decision making. And right at the end of the interview, he is asked about whether he believes Kelly Lane is still a risk to the public. And
right.
He turns to her and turns to camera and he smiles. And he then says, and I've actually taken a picture, a screenshot. He then says that she is not a risk to she is not a risk to other people, but she may be a risk to the virulent male population. And then he smiles.
She seemed to be a bit of a risk to the virile young male portion of the community.
You know, he's talking about her sexual promiscuity.
Right.
The only thing.
Yeah, that's I don't know how promiscuity is a relevant issue. And I don't know how that is part. I don't know how that should have become part of this trial at all.
But that's what it all rested on. And you'll remember, because I listened to Caro Meldrum Hannah being interviewed. And she said that when she started the documentary process, a manly police officer called her up, unsolicited, and said to her, "Do you know that Kelly Lane is known as the manly mattress? You need to know this." And she said, "That's not relevant to..."
Right, but let me just tell you something, Laura. To me, the fact that she was promiscuous could, in fact, lead to her not knowing exactly the name of the guy. It also could mean... How do you think she got pregnant in the first place? Of course she had sex with a man. And if she tells you, that this is the man's name, that may be what he told her. And whether it's a lie or not, we don't know. But it's clear that she did have sex with a man. So saying that she's promiscuous, how does that cut against her? How is that proof against her? It really makes no sense.
Well, bearing in mind we've seen other cases and even with the Dawsons, the sexual promiscuity, that seems to be irrelevant to their case.
Right, to their case.
It's highly relevant. And this double standard is what I have a real issue with. that, yes, she's a liar. Okay, I can see that. And of course,
well, but is she a liar? Because she changed the name? Is that what you're saying?
Her pregnancies. And I mean more in that sense. She hid the pregnancies. She lied about them, even to her partner. She had a partner for a number of years who didn't even know she was pregnant. For 4 years, she had multiple pregnancies. Now, he was a rugby player. It's a question how he didn't know that she was pregnant. You know, if they're being intimate, or then of course she must have put on some weight. But people around her apparently didn't know. And it's more, when I'm saying she's a liar, she has concealed pregnancies. Now, as you know, people lie for lots of different reasons. That doesn't mean to say, therefore, ergo, she is guilty of murder. But she may have lied because of how those births came about. You know, it could be through rape. It could be through trauma. It could be just the shame or the stigma, the fact she gets pregnant. She wants a termination. She can't have a termination. It could be that her family were very strict. I mean, there can be all sorts of reasons for why.
Well, we have so much more to talk about. This is an amazingly fascinating aspect of the Teacher's Pet podcast and the case of Lynn Dawson's disappearance and murder. So when we come back next time, we'll continue with this. And thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.